I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Abraham Lincoln is widely considered America's greatest president, and his assassination in 1865 remains a source of fascination many decades later. There's a forthcoming movie by Steven Spielberg, and season after season, books about Lincoln come out. Paul Serup joins me now. He is the author of Who Killed Abraham Lincoln? It was published a couple of years ago, but it's worth looking at. He joins me now to talk about why he wrote this book and who he believes killed Lincoln. The focus of the book is Charles Chiniquet. He was a Quebec-born priest who championed temperance. He goes to Illinois to do some work for the church there, but gets into some legal trouble and seeks defense from a Springfield lawyer named Abraham Lincoln, who soon becomes a friend. Chiniquet soon leaves the church and subsequently authors a popular autobiography, 50 Years in the Church of Rome, in which he investigates the Lincoln assassination. The research that Mr. Serup does in his own book is exhaustive. We'll find out why he was interested in Chiniquet, what Chiniquet concluded, and more. Published by Salmova Press, the website for more is at salmovapress.com. Incidentally, the full subtitle of the book is An Investigation of North America's Most Famous Ex-Priest's Assertion that the Roman Catholic Church was behind the assassination of America's greatest president. Paul Serup joins me from Prince George, British Columbia today. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Paul Serup. Mr. Serup, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, yourself?
Very good.
So, my understanding is you read Chiniquet's biography, his book, 50 Years in the Catholic Church, in 1986.
Yeah.
What's in that book, and what subsequently interested you about him?
Well, I was basically stunned by his allegation that it was the Roman Catholic Church, that was the Jesuits that were responsible for Lincoln's assassination, and that startled me so much that I became very curious about him, and I started doing research, wrote a few letters to archives, and I had no plans of doing anything with it. I was just curious about it, and then I just continued on, and after about maybe a dozen years, I thought, maybe I should put this in a book. So that was what interested me. Along the way, I found out more about Chiniquet. I found out what a significant sort of Canadian-American figure he was. He became world famous, one of the most famous men in the world during his lifetime. He still is, according to a 2009 biography, Canada's best-selling author of all time, although he's been dead for more than a century. And the evidence showed, there's evidence, strong evidence, that he was Abraham Lincoln's closest friend. And he did quite a investigation into the Lincoln assassination. And you've done a very good job in your introduction of sort of outlining what my book is sort of explores.
Back to the what you read in that book. You mentioned that it was the biggest selling book in the country since it was written. Is it a readable book today?
Well, it was written in 1885. I'm not saying that I'm not sure that that is actually the most best-selling book, but he wrote other books.
It sold
that
a lot.
That was most popular.
Yeah, it sold a lot of copies, my understanding is, right?
Yeah, in 13 years, when it first published, after 13 years, it had gone through 70 editions, and it had been translated into a number of languages, and it was being sort of debated and talked about sort of worldwide.
About Chiniquet, he was born in Quebec, right?
Yeah, he was born in Quebec in a French-Canadian family, and then he decided that he wanted to be a priest, and he was went through the education. He had some conflicts about what he learned with his... he had also learned the Bible as a young boy, and so he saw conflicts between the Bible and Catholic Church teaching, and also his own reason, but he became a priest, and he persuaded in the mid-19th century to persuade roughly half of Quebec to give up drinking, and most Quebec households had a portrait of him in their household, and then he was invited by the second Bishop of Chicago to come down to Illinois to establish a French-Canadian Catholic colony south of Chicago, which he did. And in 1851, he was invited, and then 5 years later, as you mentioned, he was defended by Abraham Lincoln in two court actions.
So what was the gist of what happened in court there? It was a conflict between him and the Catholic Church, is that right?
Well, yeah, he became the second bishop of Chicago was replaced by the third one, Anthony O'Regan, and O'Regan was very rough on the French Canadian Catholics that were in Chicago, and Chiniquy defended them, and he didn't back down from the bishop, and there was a tremendous conflict between him and this bishop, which was well covered by the Chicago press. I mean, the Chicago Tribune reported sort of on him, published what he said about 100 times, often on the front page. So there was a tremendous clash, and he alleged that it was this bishop that was behind his prosecution by a prominent Catholic man, four court actions, two in 1855 and two in 1856, which he essentially won. And in the end, this bishop was summoned to Rome and removed as bishop. But the country and all over the world, I think, they were sort of fascinated, or certainly in the country, they were fascinated by this priest that wasn't backing down from this bishop.
And so he'd already left the church, is that right?
No, he left the church in 1858.
Yeah, and what were the reasons for that?
Well, he was told that he had to give an absolute declaration of submission to the new Bishop of Chicago, and he said he had been bothered in his life as a Catholic priest by, he explained later that he felt it was God speaking to him and saying, don't you see the conflict between what the Catholic Church teaches and what the Bible teaches? And he was told, you have to give an absolute statement of absolute subjection to me, the bishop, and he said, I refuse to do it. And the bishop said, then you can no longer be a Catholic priest. And Chiniquy said, okay, well, God be praised, and he left the Catholic Church. And then his colony in St. Anne, the French Canadians essentially left with him, and there was at least 1,000 people that left the Catholic Church at the same time. But it was a number of things. He saw scandals involving fellow priests, not unlike what we are hearing about today with scandals of priests in the United States, Canada, and around the world. So those were sort of the things that he were sort of eating away at him in a way, building up in his life.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Lincoln and Chiniquy became close friends.
Yeah.
They saw each other, I guess, after Lincoln became president after the trial and the sword, right?
Yeah, Chiniquy says in his book that he visited the White House 3 times. That's right.
Yeah, now, were they just friends? Did he advise Lincoln at all on matters?
Chiniquy says, and I tend to believe him because I've spent, getting on toward a quarter of a century sort of looking at his story and what
right.
he said and not finding out any major mistakes. He said that Lincoln wanted to talk to him about, what he saw the Catholic Church doing and Catholics doing and what did it mean. Lincoln told him that he had been warned by Samuel Morse about a Jesuit conspiracy against the United States, and which the artist and the inventor of the telegraph had told him about. And so that's what they talked about, and Lincoln told him, you're sort of the only person I can really talk to about these things. Of course, Chiniquy had been a high-profile Catholic priest. He'd been inside the Catholic Church, and so he was and as a very, very close friend of Lincoln, and Lincoln felt free to talk to him about things that he may not have been wanted to talk to others about.
This Catholic conspiracy is something that Czernicki obviously talks about in his book, and yeah. You talk about that in your book. The desire for the church to take over the United States, for one, what is that rooted in? I mean, why did they want to do that?
Well, I think it comes from the teaching of the church that it's the only true church, and basically that as it's the only true church, then all sort of governments and people should be subject to it.
And was it the idea, did Lincoln have the idea, did Czernicki have the idea that they precipitated the Civil War?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Czernicki said that Jeff Davis and his and company wouldn't have started the Civil War. Czernicki alleged that unless the Jesuit had promised them help. Help from them, help from, I believe he said, the arms of France. That is what Czernicki alleged.
And then, I guess, because Lincoln wins the Civil War, the North wins the Civil War, yeah. They decide to kill him after that? Is that?
Yes, it was a last-ditch attempt to try and... You see, it wasn't just Lincoln that was slated to be killed. It was the entire sort of ruling.
There was a plan to kill, like, the Secretary of State and other...
The Vice President, yeah, the President, the Vice President, members, Secretary of State.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, excuse me, and also Grant, mm-hmm. General Grant. And the idea was that the Constitution had no provision for replacing that many officials at once.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to paralyze the government and then also to... rally the forces of rebellion that were still in the country. The Civil War wasn't over at that time. There were still powerful, although Lee had surrendered, there were still powerful Confederate armies in the field. And actually, the last battle of the Civil War was actually fought a month later, and there was still Confederate activities in the Pacific during that summer.
So the people like Booth, people, if you know, they have sort of a fundamental or basic grasp of history.
Mm-hmm.
John Wilkes Booth kills Lincoln in the Ford Theater.
Yeah.
What was his part in the conspiracy? He's a Catholic. He was a Catholic.
He was a Catholic. Yes, it was fairly well hidden, it was not advertised, and I. Yeah, there's so much information, so many details that I'm not able to reproduce it right on the top of my head. But there was a historian called Constant Head who wrote a paper about his Booth's sister, who revealed in a letter that Booth was a Catholic. And there's other evidence that he was a Catholic, went to a Catholic church services. Catholic medal was found on his person. The allegation that he made a donation to a Catholic church, and so I believe there's good evidence that indeed he was a Catholic, and this was sort of, and I think Constant Head also said that there was, sort of elements in the church that said, well, it's best not to let people know about that. But yes, he was a Catholic, as were a majority of the conspirators. At a time when Catholics made up about 11% of the U.S. population, so they're way overrepresented in amongst the conspirators. And I've looked at this for decades, and you keep coming across. I kept coming across the Catholic Church in this picture. I don't know if I answered your question very well, but
so back to sort of where the Catholic Church is today, and mm-hmm. Do you contend that it's still their goal to take over, say, and if it is, why hasn't it happened sooner?
Well, I would contend it still is their goal. They have made some statements that I don't believe have ever been apologized for. The Archbishop of New York, Hughes, instead said in his journal that it was in their goal to convert the entire United States. I mean, you know, if you believe you're right and you want to convert, you know, everybody, and why haven't they done it? There is still very powerful, I guess, influences of Protestantism in the United States. It was founded as a Protestant nation, and it's very, they're very active. There has been much American blood shed for that nation, most of it, a huge amount of it during the Civil War. I mean, that's where the most Americans died in any of their wars by far. So there is that. You look at illegal immigration. Well, you know, this may be controversial to say, but you could also call it, you know, from Mexico, you could call it Catholic illegal immigration, because most of them are Catholics, and that has been the growth of the Catholic Church in the United States, has come from Latin America. Now, why, this question could be asked, why haven't American and Mexican Catholic authorities come out very strongly and said to the people of Mexico, please don't break American immigration law.
It's an interesting thought, indeed. Do you think? I mean, the vice president is a Roman Catholic. We've had a president that was a Roman Catholic at one point. I don't know if. I mean, I'm wondering, someone listening to us might wonder, well, what's the big deal? I mean, what's wrong with that, better that than, say, Islam, maybe? Or
okay.
How would you respond to that?
How do I respond to that? Okay. Well, there is a quote by Chinake that I went and looked up, and it comes from the Shepherd of the Valley, the official journal of the Bishop of St. Louis, November 22nd, 1851. I've gone and looked at this, and I found it, and it declared, it was in an article, it says, "If Catholics ever gain, which they surely will do, though at a distant day, an immense numerical superiority, religious freedom in this country is at an end. So say our enemies, so we believe." And if I was a betting man, I would bet that was never apologized for. As I said, you know, the article. It's in context with the article, and that, you know, that's a pretty scary quote.
Yeah, but since then, I mean, there have been, you know, other scary quotes, haven't there, from other religions, other groups.
There have been, but you can also look at, if you want to look at what's happened, you know, sort of on the ground in Mexico, I also, in my book, is an account of the persecution of evangelical Protestants in Mexico during the 1940s and 1950s, reported in the Mexican news magazine Tiempo, which is their equivalent of Time, mm-hmm. which talks about horrific persecution, Protestants being beaten, raped, and murdered. That has happened in Mexico. I'm not aware of any apology that's happened lately, or since that time. Is there a danger to the United States, to Canada, today from the Roman Catholic Church? Well, the Catholic Church, do they not assert that the Church never changes?
And we've had Catholic prime ministers here from, you know, the turn of the century onwards. I mean, Mr. Harper, I don't think, is a Catholic, but...
No, he's not.
Yeah.
I would say that...
You do, to your credit, you talk in the book about sort of the influence of the Catholic Church in Canadian politics, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you have quotes in the back here from Diane Francis. You talk about the referendum campaign in Quebec in the mid-90s. So taking the story into a Canadian context, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. No, yeah. You go ahead if you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, what about the influence that Catholics have had in Canada?
Well, I don't know if you're aware that Canada used to be a Protestant country, and it is now a Catholic country. According to the census in 1941, during World War II, Protestants made up about half the population. Catholics were about one-third, and it is now sort of roughly the opposite of that today. And the switch happened in the 60s, I believe. And right, I think you could possibly say around the time where Pierre Trudeau became prime minister. And from him, we have had many Catholic prime ministers from that time on. Harper is a change. I don't believe that it has made Canada better. Canada, and again, I apologize for, you know, not being able to pull these things off the top of my head, but I believe Canada managed to survive up to the time of Trudeau without ever having a law against freedom of speech that you get prosecuted for, you know, for saying something, you know, excluding libel, slander, and, you know, yelling fire in a theater. But after that, then we started to get laws about that prosecute people for saying things, and I don't personally think that's consistent with democracies, that we prosecute people for what comes out of their mouth. I view that as an infringement on people's freedom of speech, and things like that wouldn't be. I think that wouldn't be allowed in the United States. The Supreme Court would vote those things down. I think that we have. I mean, there's. I think there's questions about how well the Canadian democratic system has been doing. I mean, I think that there was many prime ministers like Mulroney, like Chrétien, who had scandal after scandal, and that seemed to be a function of. I mean, I guess you could argue that, or you know, it could be asserted that they seemed to be. They were Catholic men, and there seemed to be their administration was one scandal after another. I don't know if you remember Mulroney. I don't remember, you know, if you look at Chrétien and some of these other Liberal prime ministers, there seemed to be just an ongoing scandal.
I guess I've talked about Mulroney on this program for over the years and Chrétien over the years. Mm-hmm. I just don't. I guess I'm having trouble accepting the premise that their problems in government had to do with their Catholicism.
Okay. Well,
I think it had to do with other things. I think it had to do with politics or, I guess, their own. And in Mulroney's case especially, probably with his own personal nature. And maybe one could trace that to his Catholic roots, perhaps. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess... I would also, you know, look at Quebec. It has been, and I talk about that in my book. It has been a stronghold for Catholicism traditionally in Canada. It still is predominantly Catholic, and it was last year that Maclean's did an article. It was on the front page, and. I have it here, Maclean's, October 4th, 2010. Sorry, it was 2010. And the headline on the very front page, the most corrupt province in Canada. Now, I don't think Maclean's is, you know, you could call it the daily or the weekly Protestant extremist. So, you know, I read the article. I think they had good, you know, good sort of information there. You know, and then you look at, you know, other places. Well, look at Mexico. Mm-hmm. I mean, is the soil different when you cross the U.S.-Mexican border? Is the air different? Is the water different? Well, why is Mexico such a basket case of a country? you know, it's tremendously corrupt there. Well, would that come from the people's, perhaps from the people's basic value system, from their beliefs? You know, so that's, I guess, sort of the some of the things I've that have influenced me into saying what I've said.
And do you find, Paul, that Lincoln historians say are accepting accepting the premise that you propose in this book, that because I mean it is a diversion from the conventional or accepted version of history. Do you think that they're willing to buy it? Do you think?
Well, I don't think they've been exposed to it. I'm just putting the there's a man called Joseph George Jr. who wrote a paper published in the Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society entitled "The Lincoln Writings of Charles P.T. Chinnikay." And he dismisses Chinnikay as essentially not knowing what he's talking about, and it's written in a very sort of polished, sort of conclusive style, and when I read it midway in my research or somewhat early in my research, it actually stopped me in my tracks, and I actually thought, wow, you know, Chinnikay was, you know, there was nothing to this. And only after I thought, well, you know, I've spent years looking at this. I had friends in Chicago. I've gone to Chicago a number of times, and I've done research. You know, I'd like to go through point by point and see when Chinnikay messed up. And I found out that George had made sort of error after error and misquoted Chinnikay, and there was really nothing to his criticism of Chinnikay, but he is the modern critic that most others have that dismissed Chinnikay have used. And I mean, I was contacted last year by the curator of the Lincoln Connection at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library, which have my book in their collection. And he, I had interviewed him in 2008, and he and quoted him, and he thanked me for quoting him in my book. And he was saying that there's just a, you know, there's been a sort of a dearth of scholarship on Chinnikay. I think serious historians don't have a super big problem with what I've said. They just haven't been perhaps exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I may be the... I don't know how many other people have actually done an investigation into what Chinnikay said and you know, went to the... all these places, the Library of Congress, the National Archives, the Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and, you know, looked at all they did, court record and everything that was said. I believe the most modern one to do so. And so no one has gone and really checked him out. I'm just finishing a paper to be submitted to the Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society, to essentially refute what Joseph George wrote about Chinnikay, and I think that will, you know, that will help to for people to come to a better understanding of who he was. And you know, I think if you read some of the stuff on the internet, it's, you know, they're sort of dismissed as kind of a crank. But then if you read his obituary on the front page of the New York Times and read his contemporaries and how his contemporaries treated him,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the Chicago Tribune, you know, he was treated as the celebrated, famous clergyman that he was. So I think it's just, you know, it's a lot of ignorance. I came to the conclusion that Mary Surratt was guilty, and other historians, serious historians, come to the same conclusion. Edward Steers, There's another academic who wrote about her. Her name just escapes me right now. I think her last name was Larson. But these are, you know, serious historians who go into the library, spend massive amounts of time, do heavy lifting, and they come to the conclusion. You look at Samuel Mudd. You know, I came to the conclusion that he was guilty. They come to the same conclusion that he was guilty. So I just don't think they've known about him. I mean, and frankly, many of them have never heard of them. I was interviewed some weeks ago on a Toronto radio station by a gentleman, and he said he was kind of a bit ashamed to know they'd never even heard of Charles Chiniquet, who remains Canada's best-selling author of all time. And I think there has been some effort to suppress what he said and who he was. Most Canadians, most Americans have never heard of him, although he was a very significant Canadian and American figure. My understanding is that the CBC, Canada's national broadcaster, have never mentioned his name on a national broadcast, even though, as I mentioned, he's Canada's most successful author and someone who was world famous.
Paul, these are some very interesting thoughts that you have. Thanks for your time today and sharing them with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Who Killed Abraham Lincoln? The website for more is at selmovapress.com. Its author, Paul Serup, on the line from Prince George in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.